There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Remember me from 2019?
This is What Women Want with Amy Annette.
Hi, friends. I've been a silly little goose since the last upload of What Women Want. If you, like me, understand silly little goose to mean depressed, I'm still a little bit loosey-goosey, but aren't we all? We're the silly little goose gang. But I came to the realization the other day that the many, many, many brilliant people who had lent me their time, thoughts, and funny humorals means that I am behooveth to share the shows that I recorded for What Women Want over the years that I haven't released. Some are live shows, some are lockdown Zoom records, and one or two are me just using the show as an excuse to hang out with some people that I very much admire. No one has said anything they wouldn't say today, but do remember when listening that some of these are a few years old, and things have changed. You know, Lizzo was sort of maybe not cancelled yet. I think I said this on the first What Women Want, but I'll say it again and with even more gusto, but with sadness that we still need to say this. For here at What Women Want HQ, when we say women, we are unequivocally including trans women. We are also still very much Helen Hunt stans. Helen, we love you. Please come to a show. Today, I'm sharing this conversation that I have with some truly amazing people in
2020.
If you can believe it. I know it's
2020
because we are talking with some great excitement about the hot new film Parasite. But all the other observations from Desiree Birch, Candice Carty-Williams and Nish Kumar are, frankly, timeless. This was recorded live at a Penguin event at the Barbican. We more than met its brutalist excellence with our own goofy excellence. We talked about storytelling, and listening back now, I find it sort of hard to even forgive myself for keeping the genius of these three off the air cloud.
I've left in a reference to Storm Dennis at the very top, just so you really know it is 2020. I think you'll enjoy this. Desiree, Nish, and Candice are some of the smartest people. I loved talking to them about storytelling. Oh, do be aware that this starts with me in full MC mode, bringing the guests onto stage. So there's going to be a real vibe shift in a second. Adjust your earphone pods. I don't know who you are, you young people with your technology. Just adjust your volume settings if that's going to be a struggle for you. Okay, enjoy the show. Please join me in welcome to the stage the wonderful Nish Kumar! Hello. You braved Storm Dennis.
Is that what this is?
This is Storm Dennis.
Yeah. It's been a lot. I just got into town a week ago. You guys have had a lot of storms. What's with all the weather, UK? What's up?
I think you just come from California.
Yeah, I know. What's with the weather?
You okay with Storm Dennis?
Fine, thank you. Yeah.
Good. Right. Made it. Nish, Storm Dennis.
Storm Dennis blew my cap off and my jacket inflated, so I look like Bugs Bunny. But apart from that,
apparently storms with female names often have higher casualties because people take them less seriously.
Because women be crazy.
Because people take them less seriously.
Yeah, well.
So people are like, Ellen, I'm all right. Let me get my tea.
Yeah, you think after Katrina, no one would ever do that ever again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. I think more academic papers should feature the phrase, because women be crazy.
Right?
Each show we do a different misconception. This show we're doing, what women want is to tell stories. So the idea is that we're going to be looking at storytelling and storytellers and the political and personal ramifications of telling your own story or hearing someone tell your story. I also just want to say this is the beginning of a conversation, so you might not hear something that you feel heard on this stage, and that's totally fine and totally understandable, and I hope that you see this as the beginning of a conversation rather than a totally comprehensive one. Let's begin the show. Thank you. Thank you very much. So when I was thinking about storytelling being the topic, I was thinking, what storytelling is powerful. It's power. You know, it's joyful, it can be repressive, it's so many things. It's about who gets to tell your story and do you have a say in that? What does it feel like to be a storyteller? What does it mean when suddenly people are listening to you after years of being trying to sort of shout out and be heard? I also really want to think about the gatekeepers to storytelling, like who still makes those decisions? Are we seeing change in the right way? And mostly I just want to hear about like what it means to you to tell stories. Like what an exciting, powerful, privileged place to be. And I just want to hear you guys share. So thank you so much for being here. And Desiree, when you heard that the topic was what women want is to tell stories, what did you think?
I was like, I don't know. No, because I think the essential premise of that is true. I think that women do want to be able to have the mic. I mean, not all women, but, you know, I think a lot of them are like, it is time for us to be able to speak back because so much of what we are perceived as being and what our energy is or whatever is receptive. I thought I brought this thing up about comedy a little while ago about how sick I am of hearing, you know, people go like, oh, all the female comics are so dirty and all this other stuff. And, you know, I mean, I'm a dirty comic, but you have to understand that like people are thrusting dicks and sexuality at us for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And we don't get a chance to speak or even be ourselves outside of that sort of gaze or expectation or that storyline. So when we spit it back at you, don't be offended. Just go, this is what we have received as, you know, once we get this out enough and you're still listening to us, we can talk about all the other delicate, lovely things that you expect that we are, but also we are this. And, you know, there is a need sometimes to shout, yes, I am also this thing too. And like, I'm not going to hide the stuff that I've had to imbibe my entire life. I, you know, have been a storyteller in one form or another as a stand-up and as a solo performer for over half my life now, you know? So I consider myself a storyteller, but what has come out of maybe the past decade of doing that is understanding the double-edged sword of storytelling, right? Because storytelling is a means of control, right? If you are the narrator, you control the narrative, no matter what the perspectives are in any given event. If you are the one with the microphone telling it, you are showing your perspective on it. And everyone else goes like, wow, you're so right, not realizing that that wasn't fully objective. But at the same time, stories are the things that we tell ourselves about who we are that keep us trapped in certain modalities and patterns of behavior. And it's very easy to get stuck to your story in this lifetime and find yourself in this rut of being like, why can't I change? But like letting go of that sort of I am this thing is usually the beginning of that change or that evolution. So I feel like whether we do that on an individual level or on a communal level, those stories that we tell ourselves about who we are as a society even can be quite limiting at times and keep us from progressing when when the flower is really trying to open and we've got a skin on it still. So, you know, I think that from my experience being, you know, whatever, black, female, you know, person of size, all this other stuff, I have had different perspectives on things and other people. And we've come into a time where more people are thirsty for those stories because that reflects them as well. And they have not heard those stories either. And I think that is really important and healing. And everyone needs to feel like they belong in a world and a society. And for most of us, a lot of the problems stem from the fact that we don't feel like we belong anywhere under the sun. So it's important for those stories to be told and put out in the ways that fit, You know, like, you can't just do it in the traditional, like, you know, Joseph Campbell way all the time, because maybe that doesn't fit your experience and your perspective. And, you know, sometimes you got to go, blah. And, like, I think that it's cool that sometimes when I see shows or read books, they're not in the same thing that I've come to understand as a classical structure for things. And I think that that's important, to start questioning what are feminist structures for things, as opposed to even just the content themselves, but or itself. But yeah, so I am a big advocate for storytelling, even though I know it is a means of control. And I am someone who is trying to learn how to relinquish so much of a need for control over everything. So, like, when you said, what is it like to tell stories? I'm like, I don't surf, but it feels like surfing. It feels like there is a wave of expectation and attention and whatever else growing, and it is coming for me, and I better ride this or it's going to crush me. And so, you know, I get on stage and there's adrenaline because I'm like, I got to ride this wave. And when you ride it, you feel like nothing can stop you, right? And when it slams down on you, you're like, taxi, you know, like, I gotta get out of here. Sam.
Oh, thanks, that is amazing. So good. I love that your answer started with dicks in my face, and at one point you said modality, and I was like, this chick is smart.
Also, women be crazy.
Yeah. Very much the unheard tagline to my podcast. No, that's so interesting, and I really want to come back to as well the idea of when you are retelling your own stories and you realize they're negative, like, how can you get out of that? But before that, Candice, when you heard that the subject was what women want is to tell stories, what did you think?
So I am a storyteller by nature and by volition. That's another big word for you. So trying to catch up with Desiree. So I wrote a novel called Queenie, and I wrote it because I was like, okay, well, where's the representation for someone like me? And that's what I'd been missing my whole life. And I think, as Desiree said, it was like always trying to find myself in media and in books and never finding myself. So always trying to fit into different characters. So always trying to be like sassy or like really sexy or really, like, you know, so, you know, just like aggressive as armor. And so I was doing all of those things, and I was like, oh, but that's not really me, because I'm actually quite shy. And so I thought, oh. So I found that really, really hard. And I was like, okay, well, maybe go and write something, because, like, you can't be the only person who feels like this. And so it really did stem from me being like, I would love to be able to see myself or see someone like me or just see loads of different black women, because the book has like 7 main black women in there. And I wanted these women to contain multitudes and just be different versions of what people say that we are. And so that was really exciting to me. But also in terms of storytelling, I'm a writer, so I like to hide in my bed and write. And so then when people are like, now get on the stage and talk about it, that's a challenge. But it's a welcome one, because it's really interesting, because you do end up like wanting to share why you did this. And it's about talking to people and being like, what did you get from this work? Because that's, I guess, storytelling for me is an exchange in that way, because I get to like say like a version of like different truths in story to people, and then have them say to me like, what does that mean? Or like, this is how I felt about this. And you know, I've learned a lot from my readers. One reader did say to me that she hated my book so much she'd never read a book again.
Okay.
What? She'd never read a book.
She wouldn't read a book again.
She's not reading Signs. She's nothing
at all. But I quite liked that, because I was like, well, there's an energy there.
Yeah,
you know?
There's an energy.
So that's something. And so, it's good to hear. It's good to get feedback in that way. You know, I've got a thick skin, so that's nice. Wow. But yeah, so but I think storytelling to me is definitely just like an exchange of stuff. I think that's really great, even if it's hate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's really interesting as well, to hear about how you put something that's sort of whole, and you know, you proofread it and you chose the cover, and you can't control what the response is going to be. Obviously, it's been an amazingly positive response to your book, and I think no. Okay.
In ways.
Yeah. I loved it, and I think, I feel it would be really interesting for us to come back to this, like the power that you take when you take the mic, but then the sort of really the power is always with the audience. Thank you, Candice. That's great. Thank you. Nish, when you saw it was storytelling, what did that make you think?
It made me, first of all, I love listening to everything everyone said, but it does remind me of why one of the reasons I like comedy, because obviously if you enjoy something comedically, you can laugh. Whereas when I was listening to you guys, I just had this urge to be like, Yes. But it's not really socially acceptable to just shout, that is perceptive. Even though that is what I wanted to do. I, for some reason, when I read it, it didn't occur to me that I was the storyteller in the question. Because I don't think I view my job as storytelling. Even though I guess it is technically. I don't know what my job is anymore. I think if you search my name on the internet, my job is upsetting white people. I seem to have managed to monetize that somehow. Like I've converted white tears into currency and the exchange rate is good. But I thought of it as someone who is a fan of storytelling and who is a fan of films and who is a fan of books and who is a fan of TV shows. And it made me think that one of the things that I think has happened in my life is that the richness of the stories that are available to me as a fan of storytelling has increased in my lifetime. You know, I think that when you're trying to draw the sort of collective canon, you want to feel like you're drawing the best possible storytellers. And if that group that you're drawing from is only one specific group in society, you might be missing out on a whole range of stories that you haven't been able to experience. And I think one of the most exciting things that's happened in the last 20 years is the sort of, I guess, the democratization of stories and the fact that we're hearing more stories from people of color and more stories from women and more stories from the LGBT community. Like, to me, that is enriching our cultural pantheon. And I think that that's a really good and a really exciting thing. I can't conceive of a time in my childhood when people would have been so excited about a movie like Parasite, you know, that isn't in English and comes from a completely alien world and yet has such universal themes behind it. But I can't remember a film when I was growing up that was like a foreign language movie that would be doing this much box office or winning Best Picture at the Oscars. And that, to me, is really exciting. The fact that we're drawing from so many more varied groups in society is really exciting. And I think one of the reasons that's happening is because, I mean, as much as we all dislike social media, there is an increased, it has given voice and given people the tool to tell stories and shown the appetite that exists out there for them. So that, I think, is really exciting and really encouraging. And the only thing that I would say from a personal perspective is I do think that sometimes you feel a responsibility if you are from anything other than the absolute mainstream group. You have this weird relationship where you feel responsible for your community story and telling that story. And I don't know that that's a good thing, because that's, in principle, I think that that's great. But in practice, what that leads to is me going on Question Time, which I don't think is good for anyone. It's not good for me. It's not good for you. It's not good for the Asian community. But that it is that I'm really interested to hear what everybody else thinks about the kind of weird responsibility that you feel to tell stories if you're from a group that isn't part of the, or hasn't traditionally been part of the sort of cultural default. I think that that's really interesting. But mainly I thought this is a really exciting time to be a fan of storytelling, that there's lots of really interesting writing going on, lots of really interesting movies and lots of really different types of comedy and comedians coming in. And the more groups you draw from, the more likely you are to get the absolute best and most interesting stories.
Thank you, Nish. Really good. I mean, you didn't say dicks or modalities, but I did think it was a good.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I think it's really interesting to think about Parasite. We're in this time where people are, but you almost see in the response to the success of Parasite, some like real cack-handed whiteness. Like the people interviewing the various cast members, mistaking who they're talking to, the fact that none of the cast were nominated for acting roles. But the films, and I think the same thing happened with Slumdog Millionaire. Just, it is an interesting thing that even as these stories break out, it does. And the excellence of them is part of the reason that they do. It does sort of show that there's still so much resistance to the... Like, they have to work so hard to break through.
Oh, yeah. And also the big reason we keep celebrating things like Parasite is because we keep losing elections.
Sure.
And this is pretty much all we've got.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. Thinking about being fans of storytelling and thinking about what books you read or stories you heard as a child and when you... Did you ever, or what was it like when you first, you know, found yourself in a book, or when did you first start to think about storytelling in an active way? For example, for me, Harriet the Spy. She's wearing dungarees 24/7, and she's quite rude. And I really remember reading that as a child and being like, okay, rude girls get books written about them. Very nice. Do you remember finding yourself in a story?
I wish that I could say that I fully found myself in a story, particularly at a young age. Like, I think, you know, when I was a kid, I liked, like, Encyclopedia Brown, because, like, they were really smart in that book, you know? And then I got a little bit older, and I discovered, like, some Zora Neale Hurston and stuff, and I was like, oh, there's black women, cool. Mm-hmm. And it, like, wasn't until I read, like, Dietland 3 years ago that there was a fat person that was at a center of anything, like, mm-hmm. that could be part of a story. So I feel like I've been collecting bits and pieces of myself that I've been picking up from various stories, because, you know, it does take a while. I read so much like classical and popular literature that did not feature me, that I just presumed that life was a thing that these people lived, and that if I could get closer to being like these people, I might get to live. And it's so weird to like finally be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna make my own stories and try to live through those, and hopefully other people can reference those things for their sense of living or life or self in the future, because I didn't get those until much later.
Yeah, I mean, Candice, that's basically what you were saying, talking about why you wanted to write Queenie. And you were talking about sort of books that maybe said like you want to be sassy or whatever it is, but you couldn't find the whole self. I know you work in publishing as well.
I used to work in publishing.
So congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes.
Full-time writer.
Yeah. So what's it like to work also in an industry where you're surrounded by stories but you maybe don't see yourself?
It was really hard. I found it really hard, and that's why I wrote. I think I was like, because I'm seeing that there's nothing coming in either, and I'm seeing that editors are basically like, it's not really to my taste. And so then these books just never got published, and I was like, well, that's awful. And so that's why I decided to write. But also in terms of my reading, I grew up reading lots of Mallory Blackman, like over and over again, which is great. Noughts and Crosses, I was like, I'm desperate to like be in that world. Not because I wanted black people to, you know what I mean. But also then when I got older, I was like, okay, well, what is there for me now? Like in this middling age, I remember having to read the classics all the time. And I remember weirdly finding myself, or like looking for myself like desperately, and like finding myself weirdly in Heathcliff. Because I was like, he's described as like an outsider, he's described as like having dark features, and also he's quite moody. And so I was like, that's but like, how weird that that's the person in a classic that I could find myself in. Like, it's really bleak because we had to read so much, but I never found myself in like feminine characters because I was like, there is, right? Yeah, exactly. Because like the idea of like blackness and like being a bigger black woman was like, that wasn't feminine. So I was just always like, okay, am I masculine then? I think. Or, so I think I just always like sort of.
Well, the male characters get to have a full range of emotions that you're like, oh, I feel that and I hold those things in and I suffer with that. And so I guess I'm like him.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just about what you see to let you go, oh, you could also be like her if we actually showed her as a subject and not an object.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that also comes into the conversation around literature, which is often when men write, it's considered to be the human existence that they're talking to. When women write, it's the experience of being a woman. And I know that there's statistics that show that like traditionally men don't read books by women, whereas women read books by all genders. When you were reading Nish as a child and still now, like, do you look for yourself? Do you even try to?
I guess when I was growing up, there were a couple of pretty massive, quote-unquote, Indian books. So things like A Suitable Boy came out when I was a kid. I also read a book when I was 11 years old. I read a book by Salman Rushdie because I'm unbearable. But it's actually he wrote a children's book called Haroon and the Sea of Stories, which was a story he used to tell his son, and it was around the time, the sort of biographical elements to it are quite interesting because he was under the fatwa, and so he wrote this story about a magical land where people are trying to suppress stories, and he would tell his son this story, and he ended up writing it as a book because if you've got kids, you've got to try and make some extra cheddar on the side. Like, but Haroon and the Sea of Stories is such an interesting thing because it's a remix of Eastern and Western myth, and so it's a kind of hodgepodge of the Arabian Nights, Bollywood cinema, and The Wizard of Oz. And I remember reading it thinking, this is absolutely wild. I've never read anything like this in my entire life. And also, and I've said this ad nauseam, I wouldn't be a comedian if it wasn't for Goodness Gracious Me, which is a British Asian sketch show that aired in the late 90s. And I have on many occasions said that if you don't like what I do, it's their fault. But that was a really like, you know, we were like given permission. My parents were like, we're staying up because some Indians are on TV. Like, when we were kids, if there was an Indian on TV, my mum would go, everyone come.
everyone come
in the kitchen. Indian on TV. Like, and so you'd all just run in and be like, ooh. Cool.
Do you feel like when you're writing stories or you're telling stand-up or you're making your plays, I'm not in the theatre world. When you're making your plays, Desiree, no, when you're curating your solo work, do you feel like it has to be personal for people to listen? So often it has to be like your trauma or your grief is the thing that people want to hear from you. I just want to know if that's something you've engaged with or come up against or feel like you want to tell your personal story but you don't want it to feel like it's on their terms.
I think there is something to be said for like black stories and trauma, and I know that most of the black stories that we have been allowed to come through are slave stories. And I find that really hard because it's like we have a much richer existence.
We have so much trauma, right? From various points in history.
Right. But I think the books that we see go through and like the films that get made, like the leading narrative is, I mean, like, I think if you saw the Oscar nominations, the only nomination a woman of colour had was Cynthia Erivo for playing Harriet Tubman, and everyone else has been discounted. And so I think like that has been like such a huge thing. But I think that we also have this thing where we understand that when a woman or a woman of colour tells her stories, it's just her personal story, because we have had such a traumatic existence that we've dredged up to make money. And I find that quite hard. I just find it really interesting. I went to see a film the other day called Rocks. It's absolutely amazing. And it's written by this black girl called Teresa Ikoko. And it's about a young black girl who her mum is not well, so leaves her to look after her little brother. And she's 15 in school. She's got to navigate that. And at no point did I think it was her life story. But I saw so many people who were like, this must be what she went through. And I think it's just that immediate understanding that, like, if we are able to tell stories, then it's because we're dredging up our own pain.
Yes. Almost saying, like, there's no way you could have come up with this.
Yeah, I have to say quite often, like, I am not Queenie. I have an imagination that I have used to write this book. And I think my counter is always like, because obviously Ian McEwan wrote a book about a fetus, and I'm always like, is Ian McEwan a fetus? And that's my clapback every time. Thank you.
Yeah.
He was once.
So.
You know, lived experience.
I appreciate that.
A lived experience of a kind.
McEwan was writing in the womb.
I mean, it's odd because coming from the place of being a solo performer, I have based most of my work on personal experience that I then expand to be about, you know, all of us, because as a theater maker, performer, comedian, whatever, you know, the great trick is the more specific you get, the more universal a thing becomes, right? The more that you mine, whether or not it's trauma, the more you mine the thing that you know the best, which if you are on the sidelines of life or if you're paying attention to yourself, is yourself and everything going on in this ecosystem. Mm. If you start going into that, the more people from diverse backgrounds, experiences, you know, cultures can understand what you're talking about. So it is sort of like a shortcut to a translation device for, like, there's something in me that I'm trying to transmit to you because that is the essence of storytelling. Mm. And so the more detailed I get, the better I can do that. And while I have an imagination, like, I do also just, I'm like, oh, I got this shit that isn't doing any good until I get it the hell out there. And, you know, I think as this may be pervasive throughout the arts, what I know is being a theater maker, actor, writer, comedian, right? And I feel like for me, there's always needed to be a quid pro quo, to say something from my country of late. Like, I need to be giving something and I need to be getting something in order for anyone to show up to this fucking room and sit here for an hour to an hour and a half and give a fuck, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, if I'm doing a show, I need to know that I feel that I am giving somebody something that they maybe didn't have before or that they needed more of. And I need to be getting something by releasing this story, because at a certain point after telling a story enough, I'm like, I think I can stop with that one, or at least, you know, that version of whatever I'm talking about, and move on. And so because of that, I think my stories have tended to be more personal, and just these sort of aesthetics that I learned in making theater and maybe the era in which I grew up, I think that they're starting to, like, I'm starting to expand to things that are a little bit more like, oh, social commentary and this and that, because I've told quite a few of my stories and now I'm just like scratching, like, is this anything? Is this a story? Like, I don't know, you know? So at some point you do have to expand, but I think you do start with a thing that you know the best. And also there's like a vacuum for stories like mine, because they haven't been around. There aren't enough of them to have populated the field as well as, you know, as well as other kinds of stories. And so I feel the presence of that vacuum and I'm like, oh, there's space for me to say all this shit now. Let me get it all out, you know?
Yeah. As long as maybe you feel like it's on your terms that you're sharing this, whatever story that you're sharing. Nish, when you are crafting your Edinburgh Hours, I've seen all your shows and I've seen you go from talking about more personal stories and telling stories of things you've gone through, making them funny, to now feeling confident maybe to make political comment and think about the world in a bigger way. And what's that journey been like for you?
Yeah, there's almost a more boring answer to that. And some of that is just when you start writing, the only thing you really feel comfortable with is when I started writing stand-up, the only things I felt comfortable talking about were things that I had literally lived through. Mm. And so, you know, that was really, I always wanted to do political comedy because, you know, my stand-up heroes were Chris Rock and Richard Pryor, and I loved Jon Stewart, and those were the people that I really wanted to try and emulate. But just from a sort of mechanical level, you don't have the tools when you start, you know, and you often you have to build up a skill set, and then you can evolve towards making outward. It's exactly what you said, Desiree, in terms of, like, you slowly feel confident enough to go, I have the tools to make jokes and build humour. So now I can use that into more abstract conceptual ideas rather than constantly having to, you know, get on the night bus just to try and fill half an hour. You know, like...
Very much your first show.
Yeah, very much. A lot of comedian shows, if they live in London, the first hour is things I saw on the night bus.
Is writing that show a form of self-harm? Putting yourself on another night bus?
I guess now Night Tube, you know...
The Night Tube has really done more damage to comedy than I have done. I just had to build a confidence in a toolkit in order to be comfortable saying observations or external thoughts about the world and making them funny. That was, for me, was totally...
But also being more personal, I mean. So we tell stories of being on the night bus, you know, more universal. You're looking to share a universality, whereas I feel like as you sort of maybe gain confidence, you're able to share things that maybe would feel too personal.
Yeah, I'm much more... Yeah, I definitely got more comfortable... I think also you get more comfortable. When you start, you're so desperate, especially as like a young male comedian. When you start, you go through this phase of like just the basically saying all the worst things and trying to make jokes about the worst things. Like, and so then the next phase of your development is then to try and work out how to say something that's actually funny. Mm. And as you become more comfortable, again, with just the mechanics of joke writing, you start to be able to present yourself in a more complicated three-dimensional way. I think the first sort of 4 or 5 years, everyone's stand-up persona is a sort of caricature that's quite flat. And hopefully as you go along, you start to evolve and be able to talk about the other aspects of your character.
Everyone works so hard to be in a position to be heard. What's it like when you get there? Like, what does it feel like when you've knocked on so many doors, but now people just like opening doors left, right and center, being like, come on in. That was a door analogy that I took too far. And I'm so sorry about that. Ring the doorbell. It's a Ringo. Hello. So do you feel like you talked about being the burden?
Yeah, sure.
Story
I feel in the current political climate. Also, I mean, I'm absolutely in that world. Like, I talk about politics on stage, and so I feel that I have some responsibility. I don't think this is a responsibility of anyone who works in the arts. I certainly don't think it's a responsibility of any comedian, but I'm already neck deep in this nonsense. And so I feel a responsibility to represent my community in some way, you know, even if that's just turning up and looking like an ass on Question Time, just because I think, like, with everything that's going on and everything that's been happening in the last decade, there's no way that I can dip my toe into the waters. Like, I can't do a bit of politics and then go, no, that's too much. I'm in it now. And that's where I'm at with it.
I guess it's responsibility versus onus.
Sure.
Because you just don't feel like it's... I'm very political in my thoughts and like a sort of activist in my writing and my ways, but I'm not a Twitter person about that sort of thing because it's just scary.
Oh, God.
You know, like, firsthand. But, you know, so I think that's a really, really hard thing. But I do feel a responsibility to represent myself and myself well. And on the event side, I go to a lot of events, even if they're, like, really far away, or I think there's going to be, like, 7 people there, because I think if there is someone like me in the audience and she needs to kind of see that I can do this or, like, be in that position, then I'm happy to do that. But I think it's really... I think just representing yourself is an act, you know, and I think, like, doing it in the best way that you want to do that is really important. And I don't think that has anything to do with, like, being perfect or being, like, the smartest or being, like, the most interesting. I think it's just about, like, I guess when you get to the point of being able to be your most, your truest self and your most comfortable self, then that's important.
And I think that's incredibly political. Some of the reading I was doing around this about storytelling is about how feminism used to be the place where people could hear another story about being a woman. I feel really strongly that we have this thing with mainstream feminism now, where it used to be that feminism could potentially be this place where you could find this other story, another way of living, or at least find yourself within it. But mainstream feminism, and when I say mainstream feminism, I'm basically talking about lean in, okay? I'm talking about corporate feminism and this way that feminism has become like a life hack. And it's almost as if someone just walked in and was like, guys, sorry, I'm going to do an American accent. I hope you don't mind.
Go for it.
Okay, thank you so much.
And also when you need to be annoying, you know how to do it.
Well,
guys.
It's not why I was going
to
do it.
Guys? Seriously? Guys?
Also, I'm wearing a Britney mic, like a Madonna mic, and so it feels very much like I should be like, ladies, okay. It turns out all this time, all you need to do was just be more confident. Just be more confident. The problem all this time was you. Yeah. Like, to me, like, corporate feminism has, like, athleisure and, like, these sort of perfect lifestyles on Instagram. People think they can be perfect. Like, people think they can be a CEO and still get time at home to wash the kids. I mean, wash the kids. I don't have kids.
wash those kids.
The thing I love, washing my kids. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Put them to sleep, wash your kids. Lovely stuff. Yeah, I could have it all. And I feel like it's harder and harder now to find a version of feminism that speaks to the sort of multitudes of women and isn't instead saying, like, don't worry, guys, feminism is just another way for you to be more of a man than the next man. Like, lean in, don't lie down, which is what I want to write the book. Yep. It's called Lie Down, Tune Out. Just take a little break.
You've worked hard enough.
Done a lot to get here. But some of the stuff that they say in these, like, the lean-in things and the sort of the hints and the tips and the tricks, even when I was looking at storytelling, they start by being this amazing thing, being like, storytelling is about being vulnerable, it's about being honest. And then the next paragraph was like, and that's a great way as a leader to make people believe in your brand. Oh. You know, it's like everything is getting co-opted. Yeah. Is that something that you see in interact with
it? I think whether or not you recognize it, you do come up against it all the time. I am going to slightly veer off of this because I realized there was something I wanted to say about before, but maybe it ties in because we're all talking about the same thing.
Let's put a pin in it. We'll come
back. We're going to come back. No, we were speaking about the sort of the burden, the responsibility, the, you know, telling a story on your own terms. It's just like a sticky idea to me because how much can you as a storyteller do that? Because the nature of storytelling requires an audience of some form, right? Whether or not you write it and you're separate from the audience or you write it and then you deliver it to the audience, right? You need them to receive it in order for it to be a story and you have to be a storyteller. And so much of what you do as a comedian or a storyteller is framed by what the audience is responding to and not, right? Mm. And then on the other hand, I realize that so much of my work is personal because when you are a body that has a lot projected onto it, your first mission tends to be like, let me tell you what the actual story is. Because, yes. I mean, I think we've all had that experience of feeling the weight of someone's eyes and feeling what they're projecting onto you and being like, no, that's not it. And I can see what you're doing to me and stop fucking doing that thing to me, right? And so, you know, that sort of control thing as a storyteller is to be like, oh, you think that's the story? Like, let me tell you where the real fucking story is, right? And that's the great thing is that when you are yourself, you are doing the best thing you can be doing for your community, whatever that community is to be like, we are diverse. We are not monolithic. Mm-hmm. Like, we have lived experiences that are like yours. Like, know that. So the next time when you look at someone and want to come up with their story, maybe don't make it the same fucking one every time. Maybe go like, actually, let me listen for a second. So I just, you know, the thinking about like where it comes from, what the responsibility is, like how much, you know, it's something I question for myself, how much my story is framed by what people are laughing at and what they're not, because that is my damn job, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and, or, you know, if I can push it, what I can get them to laugh at, you know, and that makes me feel like I have a little bit more agency or more like, okay, let's push it somewhere else. I've been going through that, like, I'm 41, what the fuck am I doing? You know, like, yeah. Is any of this, like, is this what I want to be doing? Especially now that I have a platform to be doing a little bit more and to be feeling the sort of, you know, weight of like, oh, building my brand and whatever. And like, that's really good. But like, what is my brand? Like, what, you know, am I stuck in a certain viewpoint, identity, idea of myself? And is that something that I'm willing to stick with for however much I got left? Or do I need to shake things up? I don't know. Thanks for riding along with me. I hope any of that is useful. No, but I just feel like we're talking about stories and they are these magical, wonderful roller coasters that sometimes you're like, can I get the fuck off?
Yeah. But also, I think that circle backs really nicely to trying to think about in everyday life when you come up against the weirdness of, you know, having to be heard in a meeting, what you might need to do. And I think that really speaks to me because I feel like when I work in an office, I'm performing, it's quite subconscious, yep. but you are always like, if you need to assert yourself, you are doing more thought than I would say my male colleagues have to do to be heard. Like, I'm having to position myself, I mean physically position myself so that I'm in the conversation, and I don't, like, I make myself lean on the table so I don't let myself sit back. I would love to think about how, when you're telling the story of yourself and you're in an office environment or you're in a traditional environment, how do you control that? How do you not let it sort of overtake you? What's your experience been like?
I don't think I ever did. When I worked in office, I was exactly the same. Mm. I was the only black woman in my office, every single office that I worked in. Mm-hmm. And I found that really hard because it would be like, Candice, we've got a black author coming in. Mm. Since we're going to pitch, can you just come and sit in the room?
And say nothing, but say just nothing. Be visible. Say nothing. Just be visible so they trust us.
Like, yeah, just sort of be, yeah, exactly. Mm. And so I found that really, really hard. And yeah, it was a lot of time. And I think I realized when I was like 28, so a couple of years ago, I was like, whoa, I could be doing my work. Instead, I'm just thinking about how I'm coming across, just like in any of these spaces. Like if I've been called into a room to just be black in the room, or I'm like in a meeting and I have to say something about a book on slavery, then it's like, you know, I'm just doing so much like double think.
Yeah.
And I used to look at a lot of my colleagues, like my white male colleagues specifically, and be like, what must it be like, you know? And like when I did loads of my book stuff, because I was working and writing at the same time and my book came out when I was working, one of my colleagues, there was a Christmas party and there was always like a quiz, and someone was like, you know, you have like those fun things like most likely to X, Y, and Z. Mm. And one of my colleagues was like, no one nominated you because you're such an overachiever.
Oh,
and yeah. I was like, oh, that's really sad. Because it was like, I'm just doing what I wanted.
Mm.
I think a lot of my energy was just spent like carrying myself properly.
Mm.
And it's really tiresome.
In my school yearbook, they voted me most likely to be the Prime Minister's wife. And I went to a girls' school. We're coming towards the end of the time, so I'd love to end by just asking you, what would you like to see in the future in terms of storytelling?
I don't know. I feel like maybe I'm capitalistically unrealistic when I say, like, I want the gatekeepers to just, like, fucking listen with their ears and, like, open their minds and their hearts a bit. Like, if you find something that you like in a story, like, advocate for it, stand up for it. Like, I just feel like I'm sick of seeing the things that come into prominence just being reduxes of things that we've seen over and over and over again, because that's what most people are willing to bank money on, ultimately. They're just operating out of fear, and they're like, this is the best way to cover our bases. And it's like, it satisfies no one equally, but I guess, like, we'll all eat it, because it's like the McDonald's fries of, you know, literature or, you know, entertainment or whatever. It's like, well, I guess I'll have this. But like, sometimes you really do want something a little bit like heartier with more roughage or whatever. And it's like, you know, and like people don't know, none of these people know what anyone wants until they put something out and then everyone wants it. And they're like, oh, we're all doing stories just like this now. And everybody's really into that. And it's like, please try to like take the risk a little bit more, because no one needs to see Dr. Doolittle again.
Yes.
Again, we get the point. It's a dude, a bunch of fucking animals. Like, we got it. Like, I just, you know, but there's so many, how many times are you like, I mean, I'm 41 and I'm like, how many times I've said, like there's the original movie and then there was the musical and then there was a movie based on the musical and now they're doing another musical based on the movie. And I'm just like, poof. Like, yeah. I just, yeah, I don't know. Like, listen with your heart, do something new, take a risk, life's short, have fun.
Yeah, fantastic.
I think Parasite is a really amazing way of thinking about this, because it is one of the best films I have seen. But also, like, some of the discourse around it has been wild. So, like, I think that where, like, people are talking about the fact that, like, oh, it's like, why is it in Korean?
Yeah.
It's like, why the fuck wouldn't it be? Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Like, I don't know what the option is. And so I think, like, I'd like to see in my lifetime things change, but I think, like, it just feels like every industry, like, every creative industry needs a massive rehaul of who is in there, because these gatekeepers are, so many of them are the same person. And I think, like, even if we take, like, office experiences and transpose that to, like, all these creative industries, if you do have, like, one person of colour who is there, how much is their voice being heard? And so I think it needs to be, I mean, it needs to just be, it just, we just need to sort of like be in there in these spaces and like actually calling the shots and having opinions and not just being asked about the opinions about things of people of colour. You know, I think there is that. So I think there's just a lot of work to do. So it feels like a really hard question.
Yes.
With not like a very positive answer.
No.
But I think it very much is just time, and I think awareness, and I think like it feels like this change that we're seeing is sustainable, mm-hmm. Because I think people are louder and I think people are demanding change, and I think that even like this podcast existing is a huge thing that mm-hmm. like we didn't have before, and also just like for a white woman to be like, that's you, to be like feminism in different forms, like it should be like an inclusive thing, like mm-hmm. I'm yet to see that apart from here, you know?
Thank you. I mean, as a white lady, obviously all I'm hearing is, yes. Finally. Is it sustainable? That's such a good word. And I think probably a word that is interesting to come from your experience in publishing, to know what it's like for people to be excited by a trend, but for it to call it a trend, yes. Essentially. Mm, yeah. Nish, what's your sort of hope for the future?
In terms of... So, like, watching comedy shows at the Edinburgh Fringe, which is pretty much the only subject I'm qualified to talk with any sense of expertise on, what I would say is, being in the audience, if I may praise Desiree in person, but being in the audience at one of Desiree's shows, or being in the audience at our friend Rose Matafeo's show, and feeling the sense that this is an outstanding show that I'm absolutely loving... even though I was not part of its primary audience. Like, watching your and Rose's shows and seeing young women respond to it and know that that was primarily aimed at them, and, like, seeing massive book displays of Queenie in, like, Waterstones and, like, you know, and realising that these things are... men will also engage with these things. But seeing art whose primary function was in comedy and in literature, the primary audience was young women, mm-hmm. and feeling the energy in that room and thinking, oh, this is new. Because particularly in terms of Edinburgh comedy shows, if you're a man and you go and watch Edinburgh comedy shows, you don't even think to engage with the fact that 90% of it was aimed at you. Like, 90% of... And I think it's only in the last couple of years that I have realised the extent to which so much of the comedy I grew up watching, and I sort of grew up through the Edinburgh Fringe. I started going there when I was 20, and so much of what I've seen was, like, primarily aimed at dudes. And the fact that there is now spaces opening up for amazing comedy, but which... the way the young women are responding to it, it's like a visceral thing that they relate to what you guys are saying. Mm. And that, to me, is like, that's exciting. That's a cause for optimism. And that's... And so the gatekeepers can only do so much to block the tidal wave. You know, like, things... I know it might sound naive with everything else that's going on, but it's hard for me to sit in those rooms, feel the change that's happened since the first time I went to Edinburgh in 2006 and not feel some cause for optimism.
Great, and that's a wonderful place to end. And just as we come to...
On the man speaking.
You did wait your turn.
Yeah. And also, I'm going to speak for a good 2 more minutes. So we've come to the very end, and we always end with a fun question for these guys. So the question that I'd love you to be thinking about is what film you would reboot with a gender reversal, and if you're in it, who are you?
So when I thought, I don't know why this has come to me, because I immediately cast myself in the film.
Of course.
And what I want to play is another gender. And in my mind, I'm just kind of like, oh, I want to play like a dirtbag. Like, I want to be in a Marlon Brando super fat movie, like whatever, like latter day, like just like, and like still powerful and everyone's listening to me. But then my mind leapt to Dog Day Afternoon, okay. which is Pacino. But like, I like the idea of like, you know, the bank heist and the desperation and trying to keep all of these things from falling apart, and like what a woman would do in that situation, cast with whoever. But I think that would be something I would totally like to see a reboot of, yes, with like a different gender.
I would like that too.
That's nice. I would Die Hard is my choice.
Yes.
And good, I'm going to put a fictional character as the main character. I would choose Annalise Keating from How to Get Away with Murder.
Yes.
Because she can handle anything, mm-hmm. anything. That has been me in that series, like the whole thing for the last like month. And I would admit I would have her as the lead.
That's really good.
I think it'd be incredible.
Wearing a white vest.
Was she wearing a white vest? Yeah, and like an amazing selection of wigs.
Mm.
Like every scene, different wig.
Yes.
I think that's what
yeah. Nish?
I mean, there's a part of me that would like to, like, gender reverse American Pie.
Mm.
I think there's lots of, like, gross out comedies about young dudes, and I just, I can't, I'm too old. I've seen too many versions of a young, of five young dudes trying to get laid. Mm. And I think the gender reversal. But then as I say that, the stiff, if you gender reverse Stifler's mum to Stifler's dad,
yeah,
it becomes a horror film.
Yeah.
So in conclusion, gender reverse American Pie, and it's directed by Ari Aster, who made Midsommar. There
nice,
we go.
That's nice.
We've gender reversed it, and it's a nightmare now.
Yeah. No nightmares here, though. Only dreamboats on this day. As we come to the end of the show. Pretty good, I thought.
Great segue.
And so please join me whooping, clapping and cheering our wonderful panellists. We had Nish, Candice and Desiree. Thank you so much. And that's the end of our show. See you later. Goodbye.
You just listened to What Women Want with Amy and Ash. And you are now listening to the credits. Which means you are my kind of person. I personally never finish a podcast before the end. I want to distract myself from myself for as long as possible, thank you. This podcast could not exist without the support, both emotional and technical, of Zachary Annette and Emma Corsham. They recorded it and mixed it. I edited it, so I'm sure that explains some things.
The music was by The Artisans.
Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. In return, I hope you always get a double seat to yourself on a train. I've been Amy Annette. Goodbye.